All right, so 2 Peter chapter 2. We have just, in chapter 1, we just rehash very quickly. Peter's about to die. He says so in chapter 1 and verse 14. And so there is a sense of urgency to this message. This is a farewell speech of Peter's. And he's writing to them, and the reason is because he wants to make sure that they're strong in the knowledge of God. He wants them to stand firm in what the prophets and the apostles have said. And that is because in chapter 3, you're going to find out that the false teachers were denying the second coming of Christ. And I suggested that at the end of chapter 1 here, when he's going through talking about what he witnessed on the mountain of Transfiguration, I suggested that at least in part, the reason Peter told that event was because he Jesus was partially letting them see a little bit of what the future held. And that is that Jesus was coming back. And he was going to come back because he's king. And so, at least in part, I think that's why he tells that event, saying, listen, we're witnesses of some pretty remarkable things that happen. And this is evidence that the second coming is going to happen. And so he says in chapter 1 and verse 19 that this prophetic word has been fully confirmed. And because it's been fully confirmed, you need to pay attention to it. And there are two reasons why. In verse 20, these guys weren't making it up as their own interpretation. It's inspired by God in verse 21. Inspiration of the Old Testament prophets and their prophecy was by God Himself. And that's key because we need to ignore the chapter break. As we get into chapter 2, he's going to say, but false prophets also rose among the people. So even though there were prophets who were speaking by the inspiration of God, being true what they're saying, it is, in fact, also true that while they're speaking truth, there were some among them in those days that did not. And so you have to be careful. And so there are those false teachers who were speaking by their own interpretations. And so he says in chapter 2 and verse 1, but false prophets also rose among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them, bringing upon themselves swift destructions. And so he says, just as there will be false teachers among you. And this, when it says will be, that is a rhetorical statement. Because if you go through the book, and when you get into chapter 3, you're going to see that these false teachers are actually already there. So he's rhetorically saying this. They already exist. And he describes them. And the way he describes them here is in two ways, and that's what he's going to spend his time on in verses 1 through 10, talking about. First of all, they secretly are bringing in this destructive heresy. And that word heresy really just means departure from truth. But it doesn't always imply a negative connotation to it. For instance, Josephus, when he is writing in one of his books, I can't remember which book it was, but he was talking about the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And he uses the Greek term here, heresy, to describe them. And really, it really just means different schools of thought. And so, especially among the Jews. So you have the Sadducees, the Pharisees, you have the sects and the factions, the divisions. So it's not necessarily always a departure of truth. In this case, it is, because we're talking about false teachers here. And what makes it even more false is how they're doing it. And that's the idea that Peter wants to convey to these Christians. It's because they're bringing it in secretly. And that's what makes this so dangerous. If they're bringing it in secretly, then they are trying to subvert the apostolic teaching. And so that's what you have to be careful about. They're among you, but it's important to know the will of God. It's important to know the scriptures, because they're going to be coming in. They may come in behind your back. You may not even know it. That's their purpose. That's how they try to do this. So the key word here is secretly. And because of that, it's destructive. Those are the two words that you connect together. It's destructive because they're bringing it in secretly. Because they're trying to teach something other than what the apostles have been teaching, along with the false, or along with the prophets of old. In Acts chapter 20, when Paul is talking about, he's talking to the elders at Ephesus, he makes sure that he's talking to them and warning them to be careful, because there are going to be false teachers among you. And the way he describes them is that they are wolves coming in sheep's clothing, and they're going to come in to try and take hold of those who are vulnerable. And that's exactly the idea here. They are coming in secretly. They're coming in, they're wolves, but they're coming in as though they are sheep to try and destroy. The second thing he warns them about is that they deny the master who bought them. And that can mean a couple different things. It could just mean that they're denying Christ, which that is true if they are teaching something other than what Christ has been teaching. It could be that the false teaching itself is denying some cardinal truth about the nature of Christ. And so there, those are a couple of options. It could just mean that it could just be talking from a practical standpoint. If you think about John's gospel, Jesus was talking about those who were denying Jesus coming in the flesh. And you don't need, in other words, we don't need Jesus. And maybe they're denying the master in that sense who bought them, because they don't live at all like he said to live. And so it's simply by lifestyle alone that he may be talking about. So what do they bring upon themselves? That's right, swift destruction. And if you look at verse 2, look at who follows. And many will follow. And they're going to follow their sensuality, and because of them, the way of truth will be blasphemed. And sensuality here is the same word that's used in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3. It's the same term. It really literally just means the absence of restraint. They had no restraint. And they're going to be those who follow that pattern of life. And because of them, because of this, they're going to blaspheme the truth. And I think that's a pretty scary thought. I think about the example of David when he was when he had sinned with Bathsheba. Remember, Nathan comes to David, and the New American Standard, I wrote this down here. When Nathan comes to David, he says, "However, because by this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born to you shall surely die." And the idea is that behavior, your behavior and your conduct, leads people to do one of two things: either praise the Lord or blaspheme the name of God. And if you're not living within the realms that God has set up, and you're doing what these false teachers are doing, then the way you live your life in that regard is going to, may lead others to also blaspheme God as you are. And that's a pretty scary thought. In verse 3, "And in their greed they will exploit you with false words. Their condemnation from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep." And so now, so we've looked at what they're like. Now we're looking at the motivation behind what they're doing. And he says the motivation is, first of all, greed. If you go back, or if you go forward a few verses to verse 14, It says, they have eyes full of adultery, insatiable for sin. They entice unsteady souls. They have hearts trained in greed. And so these false teachers are, I mean, they're, it's not like, well, they're just a few of them. Don't worry about them. They don't, no, they're trained. They're professionals. And so you need to be careful because they're motivated by greed. They also exploit. And I like what the King James Version says. It says, make merchandise of you. In other words, they're here to make money off of you. That's why they're here. And he says, their condemnation from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. And if you recall the story of Elijah when he's there on the mountain with the Baals, remember Elijah's teasing them about the people about the Baals. Where are they? Are they coming? Maybe they're asleep, he says. Maybe they're asleep. Where is he at? Well, Peter says the destruction that is coming upon them is not asleep. And it's going to come. It's going to be swift. So that sets us up for what he's going to talk about in verses 4 through 9. So verses 1 through 3 is the introduction to these false teachers. And he just fills us in into what they're like, what's the motivation behind this. And then he's going to make, he's going to go through a set of arguments here in verses 4 through 9. Any questions on 1 through 3? All right. So in verses 4 through 9, he's going through some pretty logical reasoning by Peter. The next section offers up some grammatical exercises for us. So in verses 4 through 9, this is really a big long sentence that's consisting of if-then statements. And we use these statements a lot at work. We call them Boolean logic. We're talking about when you're statistically programming data. Talk about Boolean logic. If this is true, then this is true. If it's not true, then we move on to the next statement. And that's kind of what Peter's doing here. So there are four ifs followed up by a then statement. So if this is true, then you know he is going to do this. And this type of argument is very common in the New Testament. The Hebrew writer does this as well, in terms of he starts with a lesser argument and he's building towards something that's greater. And so let's look at what he says. So in verse 4 is the first one. He says, for if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment. So that's the first if. If God did not spare the angels. In verse 5, if he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah. In verse 6, if by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes. Verse 7, and if he rescued righteous Lot. So if he judged the angels, if he saved Noah, if he judged Sodom and Gomorrah, if he saved Lot, look at verse 9. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. Since he did this, since there's no bones about it, that he's able to judge and to save, since he did this to these different sets of people, then be sure to know that he can do it even today, even now. So let's look at these examples a little bit for just a moment. So in verse 4, he talks about the angels who have sinned. They're going to be cast into hell. Jesus talks about hell in the Gospels, where he's prepared this place for the devil and his angels. So in terms of who is he talking about, if you want to go back and listen to the lesson on 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 18 through 22, I think that those that story there that he's talking about, I think he's referring to the same exact story here. So I would encourage you to go back and listen to that. One thing I will say about this is that what you see, I don't know if I have that. Yeah. So what you see here is that you take this second example, or the third example, sorry, Sodom and Gomorrah. When you look at Sodom and Gomorrah, it's very clear that the very next story after that is the story of Lot. And so it seems as if Peter is pairing stories together. Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot go together. That's the same story that we're talking about. And so it seems, at least logically to me, that if he's doing that, he's also pairing the angels who sinned with Noah and the others who were saved. And of course, if that is true, then the angels who sinned here would be the sons of God who came down to the daughters of men in Genesis chapter 6. And so I think that's probably what he's talking about, the same event that he seems to be referring to in 1 Peter chapter 3, where the spirits are in prison and God and Jesus, after the resurrection, goes and pronounces to them. So these angels and any angels that sinned in the past are surely facing judgment. And he says they're cast into hell. And the footnote there, and we talked about this in that class as well, but the footnote here for hell is Tartarus. And it really literally means lower than Sheol. Lower is the bottom of the barrel of those who are wicked. And that's who these angels who have sinned are. The King James Version says it's the idea of fiery judgment. And so they're kept in chains until the final day. Look at verse 5. If he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. If by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly. And if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked. So he's going back and forth. There are those he judged. There are those he saved, like Noah. There are those he judged, like Sodom and Gomorrah, because of their wickedness. But even out of those who were wicked in Sodom and Gomorrah, there was Lot, in which he took note of and he rescued and saved. Interestingly here, Lot is called righteous Lot. And there's not really anything negative said here about Lot, in fact, by Peter. Nothing at all. If you look at verse 8, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. And so, you know, and there are a list of, you could name off a bunch of people in the Old Testament who were maligned. Lot would be among them. And I probably have done my share of maligning Lot at times as well, because you think about what he did, it seems like he made a very poor choice. But Peter says Lot was tormented by what he saw. And so I just think, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but I just think we have to be careful. It's certainly true that Lot did some things that kind of leave you scratching your head. And certainly we learn that you have to be careful not to get so friendly with the world that it leads you astray, which is, you know, Peter talks about that with these false teachers. But the point Peter makes is that Lot was saved. God saved him. And so if God can punish and if God can deliver, then God knows how to rescue the godly from trials. Look at verse 9. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. And especially those who indulge in the lust of defiling passion and despise authority. And if you think about it, if the second coming isn't going to happen, just like the false teachers said, then can this be true? Can God judge and punish and save. If Jesus isn't coming back, what's the point, right? And so I think that's in part what he's saying here. Be thankful and know he is coming back. And this is one of the reasons he's coming back. He's coming back to punish the ungodly and to save those who remain faithful. And of course, what's interesting in verses 9 and 10 is that this category of things that he says here, who does it fit? It fits the false teachers as well, doesn't it? He says that they despise authority. The angels, of course, did. These sons of God who came down to the daughters of men, they rejected the authority of God. They didn't want to submit to his authority. And Sodom and Gomorrah did the same. They rejected the way God told them to live, and they lived the way they wanted to. Well, so they have, in a sense, denied the master, which takes you back up to verse 1. Peter wants them to see the connection here. Just like the angels did not submit to God, just like Sodom and Gomorrah did not submit to God, this is exactly what these false teachers are like. They also had denied the master, just like these of old did. And look what happened to them. They're being punished. And they will be judged, finally. And these false teachers are going to be under the same set of consequences. And so these false teachers are put under the same category with the angels in Sodom and Gomorrah, in the sense that they deny the master. Questions on that? Or thoughts?
I think both, you have the dichotomy of God as both the rescuer and the judge. Maybe just putting that in the context of Jesus, remembering that we kind of got the thought, modern thought of Jesus as being kind of this hippie, he's happy about everybody and wants everybody to do things, but certainly he came to rescue man.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping those things in mind as we follow him and bring others to him, we can't just present that everything's happy. We have to talk about judgment as well. It's a part of the conversation.
Yeah, certainly. It certainly is. Yep. And that's for the purpose. First, it's for the purpose of glorifying God, that both the right that he both saves and judges, but it's also for the purpose of his people. He's vindicating his people. That's really what you see throughout the Old Testament as well. He's done that with his people over and over again. He judges them, but as a nation comes in and takes over, they come back and rely upon God, he will judge those nations as well. Yeah, good point. All right, so the second half of verse 10 through 16 is this next section here. And verse 10 sets up the outline of 11 through 16. He mentions again two qualities in verse 10, of which he will speak on in this next section. First of all, they indulge in lust, a defiling passion. And secondly, they despise authority. They rebel. Which is the implication of rebelling against authority is arrogance. And that's what he's going to be talking about in this section. So insubordination he's going to talk about in 10 through 13, and then he's going to talk about lust in 13 through 16. So he says they're bold and willful, second half, verse 10, they do not tremble as they blaspheme the glorious ones. And the main point of this is that they are bold and willful. What's not so clear is what the glorious ones are. And there are two possibilities, I suppose, that you could think about. Really, they're probably either angels or they're people. And in the context, the very next verse, he's going to talk about angels. And so my guess is that's who these glorious ones are angels. The next question is, what angels is Peter talking about? And why would they be blaspheming them? And I don't know. I'm just not sure. It's kind of hard to tell exactly what he's speaking about. Some people will suggest that since the angels up in verse 4 are mentioned, that these are sinful angels, or what we sometimes call fallen angels. And so then maybe these false teachers were disparaging these fallen angels. But then others will suggest that since the law of Moses was handed down through the angels, that and these teachers clearly had no respect for righteousness or for the law, for God's law, that came by way of angels, thus they are blaspheming the angels in that sense. In other words, just take your law and your angels who gave it. We could care less. And so maybe that's what he's talking about. I don't know. I don't know what he's talking about here. However, whichever way you look at this, as to the identity or even the precise motives as to why they're doing this, Peter's point in verse 10 is that their character is such that they care little for God. And they are arrogant and they are audacious to do something like this. Look at the contrast. Verse 11. Whereas angels, though greater in might and power, do not pronounce a blasphemous judgment against them before the Lord. And so Peter says these angels, presumably righteous and holy angels, who are above these false teachers, above what is utterly wicked, do not blaspheme or speak against them a judgment before God. Why don't they? That's exactly right. Judgment belongs to God. They leave it to the Lord, right? They leave it to God. Angels are there to work for the Lord, to help the Lord, but it's not their place to judge in this way. As God is the one who does that. And, you know, in 1 Corinthians 4, Paul talks about this as well. Dealing with judgmental attitudes, Paul basically says, what you think of me, what I think of myself, doesn't really matter. What God thinks does. Because he is the one who is going to judge. And obviously, it doesn't mean we can't make judgments as Christians. We talk about church discipline and things like that. There is certainly a type of judgment that we can make. When we talk about ultimate judgment, though, and dealing with hearts, ultimately it belongs to God. We need to leave that to the Lord. And so these righteous angels have respect for authority, unlike the false teachers who think themselves great. But look at verse 12. But these, like irrational animals, creatures of instinct, born to be caught and destroyed, blaspheming about matters of which they are ignorant, will also be destroyed in their destruction. It's pretty scornful what Peter has to say. They're like, not only are they arrogant, but Peter says they're ignorant. And when you take an ignorant and arrogant person, you have a pretty deadly combination. And he calls them irrational animals, which animals, you know, they have some intelligence, but they don't reason. Mark Twain said, you talked about, you know, you have a cat that jumps on a hot stove. He's not going to jump on the hot stove again, but he's also not going to jump on the cold stove. And that's really, you know, the idea here, that they're animals who are driven by instinct. And that's basically all they do. They're driven by instinct, but they're not driven by reason. And that's what these teachers have become. They're driven by fleshly impulse. And what's scary is that they don't realize what they've become. They think they're great. They think they're mighty. And yet they're blaspheming the Lord. And they're doing that about matters of which they are ignorant, he says. And assuming he's still talking, maybe he, you know, could be talking still here about angels. But Peter says they aren't experts. And you need to understand that. And in fact, they are the exact opposite. They have become like animals, blaspheming about things that they have no business talking about. And so they're destroyed in their destruction. The New American Standard says, "Will in the destruction of those creatures also be destroyed." Or the NLT says, "They're like animals and they too will perish." And so they present themselves as knowing everything, being great scholars. But they aren't. They're ignorant and they're arrogant. And instead of being brilliant people, as they try and portray, they're reduced to animals and they're going to suffer the same fate. And when he says destruction, probably destruction here is the same destruction that Peter's going to talk about when you get into chapter 3. And so he says they're suffering, suffering wrong as the wage of their wrongdoing. Verse 13, suffering wrong is the wage of their wrongdoing. They count it pleasure to revel in the daytime. They're going to reap what they sow, is Peter's point. They will be paid back for what they've done, suffer wrong for their wrongdoing. What's interesting is if you go back up to verse 3 of this same chapter, it says, "And in their greed, they will exploit you with false words. Their condemnation from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep." So they're motivated by greed. They want a paycheck. And here in verse 13, Peter says they're going to get their paycheck. They're going to get what's coming to them. This next part of this section, he talks about them indulging in lust. They count it pleasure to revel in the daytime. They are blots and blemishes, reveling in their deceptions while they feast with you. And the word revel here means to carouse. It's really the idea of they are living a wild life. And even in our culture, this behavior is reserved for nighttime usually, right? Well, they don't even worry about the nighttime. They take advantage of this in the daytime. There's no embarrassment about what they're doing. They pleasure in this during the daytime. And Ecclesiastes talks a lot about this. Isaiah does as well, getting drunk. Isaiah talks about them getting drunk in the middle of the day. And they talk about that to describe that this is a culture that's in decline. And that's really what they're talking about here. This culture is in decline. These false teachers are in decline. He mentions them feasting. It could simply mean here that this is just a simple meal. They're coming together to eat with them. Some have suggested that maybe this is the Lord's Supper. In Psalm 41, David mentions eating a meal with someone who he thinks is a friend of his just to find out that he's going to stab himself in the back. So whatever the case is, be careful. They're coming in secretly, and they are socializing with you, but in reality are always trying to get back at you. It could also very well be, you know, Jude seems to be making the point when he's talking about false teachers, that these are those who are among you. They are within the same group that worships with you. And it's very possible that could be the case here. That there are these people know you, they're living among you, they're worshiping with you, they're coming in, and that's how they're able to be in here secretly. But be careful, because they'll just be there to stab you in the back. Another example would be Judas. You think about what Judas did when he was eating a meal with the disciples and with Jesus, just to head out early so he could go and stab Jesus in the back, so to speak. The main thing is that their character, while they do it, is, you know, he says they have blots and blemishes. If you look in verse 14 of chapter 3, he's going to use this same phraseology in the opposite sense. "Therefore, beloved, since you are waiting for these, be diligent to be found by him without spot or blemish and at peace." Make sure you're not like these men. You are to be the opposite. So he's really just conveying the idea. These are phonies. So you need to be aware of that. Then he says they have eyes full of adultery, insatiable for sin. They entice unsteady souls. They have hearts trained in greed. Again, these are professionals, and they are cursed children. So they train daily, year after year. And they're able to get away with this, again, because they're experts at what they do. He calls them accursed children. And in Hebrew, the phrase, if you think about the phrase son of man, that literally in Hebrew means you are a man. Judas, it says that he was a son of perdition, means he's going to get destruction. And accursed children, Peter is saying, you are under the curse. You are going to face the judgment that is due you. You know, when you think about why would these people do something like this? I mean, what could possibly be their motivation for doing that? And he talks about that. He leaves you scratching your head. They spend all this time trying to be perfect at this job. And they're motivated by greed. And they entice people into adultery. And comes and it's going to come under the judgment of God. Now that I've said that, when you think about Peter trying to use an example of somebody who's like that in the Old Testament, somebody who's a false prophet, he's motivated by greed, he entices people into adultery and comes under the judgment of God, what better person to go to than the story of Balaam, right? The son of Beor. So he says, forsaking the right way, they have gone astray. They have followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved gain from wrongdoing, but was rebuked for his own transgression. A speechless donkey spoke with human voice and restrained the prophet's madness. So if you think back to that story, you have Balak, the king of Moab, who hires Balaam out to curse God's people. And Balaam is not able to do it. In fact, he keeps blessing them, which frustrates both Balak and Balaam to death. And then God uses an interesting person to rebuke, or interesting subject to rebuke Balaam. And God can make anyone speak on his behalf, even a donkey, which Balaam was riding on. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because how does Peter describe these false teachers? That's right, they're dumb animals. That's right. So maybe Peter's using a play on words here a little bit with this story. Now, there's something that's not so obvious about that story that I think it's crucial. Did Balaam have any success in bringing harm to Israel? He did. Now, at first glance, when we think about that, well, he didn't get to curse them like he tried. He ended up blessing them. But what transpires after that was a very terrible time for Israel. And so I want to just go back and look at something for just a moment in Numbers. And what I want us to just see, no, he didn't curse him like he tried. Yes, the words that came out were blessings to God's people. But he still had a very bad, he impacted them spiritually in a devastating way. And it's an ugly story. So Numbers 22 through 24 is really the where this story takes place. If you go to chapter 25, in verse 1 through 3, while Israel lived in Shittim, the people began to whore with the daughters of Moab. These invited the people to the sacrifice of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel yoked himself to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. It's an ugly story. And you wouldn't necessarily assume this chapter is connected with Balaam. except for the few points where it talks about Moab being involved, and then idolatry and sexual immorality. But then look at Numbers 31. Verse 15, Moses said to them, "Have you let all the women live? Behold, these, on Balaam's advice, caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against the Lord in the incident of Peor, and so the plague came among the congregation of the Lord." So, yes, he was unsuccessful in cursing Israel, but he harmed them through the snare of idolatry and sexual sin. And Balaam was put to death for it. False prophet, motivated by greed, enticing people to sexual sin, and he came under the judgment of God. He's reduced to a dumb animal. And that's what Peter says is going to take place with these false teachers. The same thing that happened to Balaam is going to happen to these false teachers. But he says, be careful. Because those people fell under his curse. And you will do the same if you're not careful to realize who these people are and how dangerous they can be. The appeal is that it appeals to your base desires. That's why people follow after this. That was the first bell. All right. So 17 through 22 describes them and describes their judgment. And so verse 17, he describes them as the spring without water. What good is a spring without water? That's right, it's not a spring. It promises something, but it doesn't pay off, is the point. Which is the contrast to the truth, which is a fountain of life. And he also describes them as a mist driven by a storm. If you think about the idea of maybe you're outside and the cloud, it gets dark, it gets overcast, and you start to get a little bit of a sprinkle and think, wow, we're going to get a good storm. And then the wind just blows it miles away from you. And the next county over, it gets the rain and you don't. And that's kind of the idea. And the NLT translation says that it's blown away by wind, or value is worthless. And so they're going to face this gloom of utter darkness that's going to be revealed, which is the same as what he talks about with the angels who sin in verse 4 of the same chapter. In verse 18, there's loud boasts of folly, or swelling words of emptiness. King James Version says swelling words of vanity, or speaking out arrogant words of vanity. A phrase we might use is that they're full of hot air. Might be a way we would say that. They're arrogant. And they think they have authority, but they have none. And so they entice by fleshly desire, which goes back up here to verse 14. Says the same thing. And who do they entice? In verse 18. That's right. Those who barely escape. The NIV says those who are just escaping. So, and there's a little bit of a difference between barely and just escaping. Barely might imply a new or a mature, or new or mature doesn't really matter here. But these are Christians barely hanging on. They're weak in the faith. If it's just escaping, it might be one who's just been converted and have come out of the world, but they still have the old habits fresh on their mind. I don't know which one it is. It could be both that he has in mind here. But how cruel is that? Exploiting those they know they can take advantage of. And that's really the example of the Amalekites, right? That's why God punished them, is because when they were trying to get to the land, the Amalekites cut off the tail, it says, of Israel. They took advantage of those who were poor, those who were weak, those who were vulnerable. And that seems to be the idea that he's talking about. These false teachers are exploiting people who are barely escaping paganism or this pagan lifestyle. They've come out of that, but they're trying to get hold of them while they can. All right, we almost got through chapter 2. We'll look at this last little bit here and then look at the last chapter on Wednesday.